Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The pressure is rising around Iran. New sanctions, more countries, now Europe and Australia, saying they won't buy Iran's oil. Iran threatening the Strait of Hormuz and moving inexorably forward, we're told, on its nuclear program. The fear is nuclear weapons. The debate is how to stop them. Cool heads say talk, pressure, negotiate. Other voices say preemptive strike and soon. This hour on Point, the case for and against military action to stop Iran's push into nuclear territory. You can join the conversation. Can you picture what happens if the U.S. goes to war with Iran? What happens if it doesn't? Does just discussing it launch the war drums or quiet them? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A pair of big essays in the current issue of Foreign Affairs has put the arguments for and against a U.S. military strike on Iran in the spotlight. Their authors are with us. From Washington, Matthew Krenick, professor of government at Georgetown University, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. From July 2010 to July last year, he was a special advisor in the office of the Secretary of Defense, looking at Middle East defense policy and strategy. His article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs is Time to Attack Iran, Why a Strike is the Least Bad Option. Matthew Krenick, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us, Colin Call, professor in the Security Studies Program in the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. From February 09 to December last year, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon. His article in the same issue of Foreign Affairs is Not Time to Attack Iran, Why War Should Be a Last Resort. Colin Call, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Matthew Krenick, let me come first to you. And just so people understand, we'll talk all about the rationale. We'll talk about the background as you see it, the argument as you see it. But would you describe for us what this strike would look like in its beginning? What would the targets be? How many? How big a U.S. force are you talking? We'll come back and look at the rationale. But just describe what it is that you're putting on the table.
Well, first, let me say that I would be absolutely delighted if Iran and the international community were able to come to some kind of negotiated settlement. I just see that outcome as highly unlikely.
We're going to look at that. What would the strike be?
So the strike that I call for in the Foreign Affairs article would be a surgical strike against Iran's key nuclear facilities. So it would be the uranium enrichment facilities at Natanz and Qom, the uranium conversion facility at Esfahan, and the plutonium producing reactor at Iraq, and then also some other uranium enrichment component manufacturing facilities, and then whatever air defenses we'd have to take out in order to get to those facilities. So what I would be urging is a surgical strike, not a larger conflict, and certainly not a ground invasion.
Some of Iran's facilities, we're now told, are deep underground, some in the mountains. Do we have bombs that could actually take them out?
So we just introduced a new bunker-busting bomb, the massive ordnance penetrator, capable of penetrating up to 200 feet of reinforced concrete. And so, as you point out, the facility at Natanz, for example, is buried and hardened, but it wouldn't withstand an attack from the massive ordnance penetrator.
Are you talking a U.S. strike or a U.S.-Israeli strike? What would the forces be here?
Well, there are a lot of different ways that this could play out, and Israel certainly has been unwilling to take the military option off the table. But what I would advocate would be a U.S.-only strike. The United States has greater capabilities to inflict lasting damage on Iran's nuclear program, and I think would also be better able to handle the consequences of a strike.
And what are you suggesting would be the impact of an American military strike on Iran's nuclear program? Would it be a six-month setback, a permanent disabling? How big a blow would it be?
Well, the first thing I should say is that any of these estimates are highly speculative because they depend a lot on guesses about things that we simply can't know beforehand, such as does Iran decide to reconstitute its program at all? How quickly does it decide to reconstitute its program? Is it able to get materials on the international market? What type of post-strike containment regime is the international community able to put in place? So all these estimates are speculative, but my best guess is somewhere between a 3-year and 10-year delay. And the hope, obviously, would be that this delay would become permanent, that in this amount of time that we buy, something changes. Iran buys greater space for diplomacy, and we're able to get to a situation where Iran is permanently without nuclear weapons.
There's been a lot of pushback to your article. What do you make of it? Stephen Waltz calls it a textbook example of warmongering disguised as analysis. Tom Rick says, I can't believe we're discussing this. These are people who think a lot about security and defense. Have you leaned too far forward here, Matthew Koenig? Panetta, said last fall, you know, get into this and an escalation would consume the Middle East in confrontation and the conflict that we would regret.
Well, Panetta also said just a few weeks ago that if Iran attempted to build nuclear weapons, it will be stopped. So I think his rhetoric, at least publicly, and the administration's rhetoric, at least publicly, has gotten tougher on this issue. And to be honest, I've been a little bit surprised by all the controversy. You know, it has been the stated policy of two successive presidents that a nuclear-armed Iran is, quote, unacceptable, and that, quote, all options are on the table to prevent that from happening. And I'm afraid we're reaching the point where we're going to be forced to accept the unacceptable or exercise our last remaining option. One of those things is a paradox, and the other one isn't. So it seems like this is kind of a logical continuation of our policy.
We'll turn back and look through the rationales here. Colin Call, what do you make of the argument that Matthew Koenig constructs for going and going soon? I mean, the headlines in his article are, you know, are like any time is good, a strike now or suffer later. What about this argument, Colin?
Well, I mean, the argument that I make in my piece is that while all options, including the military one, should remain on the table, force should be a last resort and not a first choice. And we're not on the brink of Iran having a nuclear weapon. I think that's what it's really important for your listeners to understand. The timeline in Matt's article of, you know, they could have a bomb in 6 months is actually highly misleading. They could maybe generate a testable device within a year, maybe a deliverable device for a missile within several years. But those timelines don't even start until the supreme leader of Iran makes a decision to dash for a bomb. And there's all sorts of reasons to believe that he's very unlikely to do so anytime soon, because if he did, he'd get caught. So it's likely that Iran is many years away from having a bomb. And so the argument that I make is, we need to avoid the mistake that we made in 2002 and early 2003 in the run-up to Iraq, which is to hype the danger of a nuclear Iran, to make the argument that they are on the brink of having a devastating capability that could destabilize the region, and then to downplay the significant risks associated with the strike. It's not to take the military option off the table, but to say that we shouldn't rush to deploy it.
Is there such a thing in your mind as a surgical strike that could take out Iran's nuclear capacity and then let the U.S. Retreat from the field?
No. It's quite simply no. First of all, taking out the nuclear program would be a huge blow to the regime in Iran. They see it as its crown jewel. They've invested an enormous amount of international and domestic legitimacy in their nuclear pursuits, and they're likely to retaliate much more in a much more widespread fashion than Matt talks about in his article. And it actually wouldn't take very much retaliation for them to bring the United States military in completely. Let me give you just one example. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Strait of Hormuz in the opening. You know, in Matt's article, he says that the United States should basically turn the other cheek if the Iranians, you know, do a small amount of mining in the Strait of Hormuz or start harassing commercial traffic.
In other words, it would be worth it to take out the nuclear program than to settle things down by turning the other cheek afterward would be a worthwhile sort of a little suffering for the bigger goal, Matthew Koenig says.
Yeah, basically to absorb the punch.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. It doesn't actually work if you think about how the military operations will happen in practice. Let me give you an example. Let's imagine that the Iranians only put a handful of mines into the Strait of Hormuz to scare international shipping. The United States and our coalition partners would be forced to clear those mines out of the strait. It takes 200 times as long to clear a mine as it does to deploy them, and we only have a very few ships that can actually clear the mines. Those ships would be incredibly vulnerable to Iranian anti-ship cruise missiles on other ships and on the shore, and we'd have to protect them both with our Navy and with our Air Force, which means even to clear a handful of mines, we'd have to devastate Iranian coastal defenses, devastate their integrated air defense network, and sink a huge proportion of their Navy. That is not a surgical strike. That is an all-out war against Iran's military.
You have both recently been working in the Pentagon. Colin, you've been there a little more recently. What's the Pentagon posture on this? And we see Panetta's statements. We'll hear some of them. But is there a camp inside the Pentagon that is in Matthew Kranich's corner here saying, let's do it and let's do it soon, now?
I think one thing that's really important for your listeners to know is that, you know, Matt and my arguments need to kind of rise and fall on their own. They don't represent camps inside the administration or inside the Pentagon. They don't, you know, represent official views.
But it is head-turning that you are both very recently out of the Pentagon.
Yeah. I mean, look, the United States has made it clear, this administration and the previous one, that all options are on the table. And President Obama has made it very clear to his military commanders that when he says all options are on the table, he means it, and that those options have to be viable. So the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and others have made clear that we have viable contingency plans for going after Iran if we have to. But they've also repeatedly made clear that that is a very bad option and that we should exhaust every other option, diplomacy, sanctions, pressure, negotiation, before we go down that route. And we're not anywhere near close to exhausting those alternatives.
Matthew Kranich, in a word, we're up against a break here. Is there support in the Pentagon for what you're advocating here? Do it and do it soon?
Well, I think Colin's caution is absolutely right, that our articles represent our own views and don't represent the views of the U.S. government. But, you know, this is Iran's advancing nuclear program is probably the most vexing national security challenge facing the country, and there's a range of views both in and out of government on how to deal with it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about what you might call the backroom debate over war with Iran, an argument to strike now against Iran's nuclear program. An argument that that would be unwise, rash, too costly. With us today from Washington, Matthew Kranich, his piece in the current issue of Foreign Affairs is Time to Attack Iran, Why a Strike is the Least Bad Option. He was until recently working inside the Pentagon as an advisor there. Colin Call joins us as well from Washington. His article in the same issue, Not Time to Attack Iran, Why War Should Be a Last Resort. He was, until December, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon. Here was an interview with Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta on 60 Minutes with Scott Pelley in December, saying the U.S. would not let Iran get nuclear weapons.
If they proceed and we get intelligence that they're proceeding with developing a nuclear weapon, then we will take whatever steps are necessary to stop them.
Including military steps.
There are no options that are off the table.
A nuclear weapon for Iran is
unacceptable.
Unacceptable. There's that word again. But what does that mean exactly? What about all the sanctions that are out there right now? Will they bite enough? Could they bite enough to turn this around? Matthew Kranich and Colin Call are with us. Matthew Kranich, let me come to you. Colin Call says, look, it's not imminent. And so why are we talking about a strike, number one? And number two, there's no such thing as a surgical strike. In for a dime, in for a dollar here, it'll be big and it will be messy.
Yeah, well, those are both good points. What I would say in response is what I argue in the piece is that there are certain red lines that if Iran crossed would create the decision points for the use of force. So I argue that if Iran enriches its uranium beyond the 20% that it's enriching to now, up to the 90% that it would need for a nuclear weapon, if Iran expels International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, or if it installs advanced centrifuges in its uranium enrichment facility at Qom, that's when the United States should attack. And so while we might have time, it's not in our control. It would be up to the Iranians to make the decision of when to do that. And so rather than reacting to that, I think that we should start laying the groundwork now in terms of international diplomacy to prepare for that possibility. So while I wouldn't advocate a bolt out of the blue strike now, I do think that we should begin now to build support to make it clear that that is a real option that's on the table. The second thing that I would say in terms of Colin's argument that things would get out of control and likely result in a broader war, I think Colin is absolutely right to point out to the potential downfalls and that we need to prepare for both the worst case and the best case scenarios. But when I look at the situation, I think there are also strong incentives for restraint on all sides. So if you put yourself in the shoes of Iran's supreme leader, for example, your primary goal is for your regime and for your country to continue to exist. And you know that a full-scale war with the United States is going to result possibly in the destruction of your military and in the destruction of the regime itself. And so you wake up one morning and your key nuclear facilities are destroyed. It presents Iran with a real strategic dilemma. How do I respond? On one hand, Iran would certainly retaliate to save face domestically and to reestablish deterrence internationally. On the other hand, it's going to want to avoid, again, getting into a war that's going to lead to its own destruction. So it's going to aim for some kind of calibrated response. And on the U.S. side, I think Colin is right to point out the dangers that there's going to be political pressure on the White House to respond to any type of Iranian retaliation. But I think the United States should be content to trade Iran's nuclear facilities for retaliation. And then there are other possible scenarios about how things could spin out of control. But I point out in my piece different ways we could mitigate that and different reasons why I think it's unlikely. And cool. I do think it's possible that the strike could remain limited.
Colin Kyle, the critique of Matthew's piece is that that a number of people have put forward is that it provides a sort of worst case scenario before an American strike about the threat, the danger, and the rosiest case after about how everything might be wrapped up, mopped up. The U.S. would restrain itself. Iran would restrain itself. Let's look at the Iranian retaliation piece. What real capacity for retaliation does it have? How wide would that be? And do you agree that the regime in Tehran might say to itself or would say to itself, you know, we don't want to get into a real full-scale kind of all-over-the-place war here. Let's just take this hit to our nuclear program and, you know, do some symbolic retaliation but not go hog wild?
No, it's a good question. Look, Matt admits in his article that the regime would retaliate in some pretty dramatic fashions if it felt that the regime itself was under threat. And as I made an argument before we went into break, attacking its nuclear program and knocking out a chunk of its integrated air defense network would be seen by the regime as an enormous threat. And they're likely to retaliate. They're big and small. So let me give you some examples. Mm-hmm. At the very least, they're going to have to reestablish deterrence by launching some missiles at U.S. facilities in the Gulf. They're likely to start threatening international shipping. Their proxies in Iraq and potentially Lebanon could engage in terrorism and rocket attacks against U.S. diplomatic facilities there. They may increase support in terms of very advanced lethal assistance to the Taliban in Afghanistan. They could try to get Hezbollah to try to drag the Israelis into the fight. Assad's regime in Syria might see this as a diversionary opportunity. So there's all sorts of ways in which this war widens rapidly. And if large numbers of diplomats are killed in Lebanon and Iraq, the political pressure will mount for the United States to do something. If our soldiers die from missile strikes, the pressure will build to do something. If shipping is harassed in the Strait of Hormuz, we will do something. That is a stated red line by the U.S. military. So this is not a game where you can anticipate every move and put in place blocking moves that limit escalation. If we're going to go to war with Iran, your listeners need to understand it is a war. It is not a set of strikes, and it'll be a war that consumes the region.
What would that look like? I think we could flesh that further out. I mean, we understand we've seen what Iraq looked like. It was essentially internal to Iraq. It had to do with sort of getting the population settled back down after the hornet's nest and Hussein out. In the case of Iran, how far flung? How fierce? Would it involve boots on the ground in Iran, American boots, or would it just be, you know, strikes from the air and trying to contain the spillover beyond the country?
Well, I don't know that anybody's advocating a land invasion of Iran. I think Matt certainly isn't advocating that. He's arguing basically for air and naval strikes against Iran's capabilities. It's unlikely that the United States would introduce forces on the ground, although some of the nuclear – depends on how expansive your nuclear target set and whether you thought you needed special operators on the ground to help out with some of that. But you're not talking about a land invasion, nor do I think a lot of people are arguing for regime change, although some are capitalizing on arguments like Matt's to make that case. You saw another piece in Foreign Affairs to mm-hmm. making that case. I think the broader danger is that we could easily get dragged into an escalatory cycle with the Iranians. they're not going to respect our red lines once we've taken out the crown jewels of their regime. And they don't like us. They don't respect us. They don't trust us. And the ideology of the supreme leader and many of his hardline advisors is such that anti-Americanism is at its core. And so they're not going to believe that we're after limited aims. They already think we're trying to overthrow the regime. And when bombs start dropping on their country, they're going to lash out. And when they do it, it's going to create possibility for escalation, not only with us, but also in the Levant with Israel and Lebanon, potentially Syria, dragging the Gulf states into the fray, escalating things in Afghanistan and Iraq. This is not a small thing. This is a very, very big thing.
I still think it's hard to picture that very big thing. Are you talking in the aftermath of this incredible step, the surgical strikes against all these nuclear facilities? I mean, this would be huge. But in the aftermath of that, are we talking tanks rolling across borders? Are we talking the occasional, are we talking a flurry of missiles and then the equivalent of kind of, terrorist or, you know, commando attacks by Iranians later? The texture of it is still vague to me.
That's a good point. Look, there are three major mechanisms for them to retaliate. One is with their missile arsenal. At the very least, they're likely to launch missiles at U.S. facilities to reestablish their deterrence. I also make the argument in my piece that they feel that their missile arsenal is very vulnerable, which means they're likely to expend a lot of their missiles early in the conflict.
Shoot them off quick.
Kind of use them or lose them. Mm-hmm. That's scenario number one, missile strikes. Scenario number two is they will certainly increase assistance to proxy groups, such as Shia militant groups like Asaib al-Haq and Kateb Hezbollah inside Iraq. Lebanese Hezbollah will be encouraged to launch attacks against Israel, potentially against us. They'll increase assistance to the Taliban. They'll increase subversion and terrorism in the Gulf. So that's the second pathway, terrorism, proxy violence. And then the third pathway is, of course, their navy. And it's not their regular navy I'm worried about. It's the Revolutionary Guard Corps navy that operates in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, using small boats, mines, submarines, anti-ship cruise missiles to threaten the U.S. Navy, to threaten international shipping. And as we saw from the last month or so, it doesn't take much Iranian saber rattling to get the U.S. military pretty involved.
Matthew Koenig, one of the arguments that gets the pushback that you get is that if the U.S. does this at this moment, we've got the Arab Spring going on, lots of ferment in this region. If suddenly in the midst of that, we've got American planes like all over Iran, surgical strikes, call them what you will, there will be collateral damage, as it's called, the people will die around these attacks. That you turn the chemistry of the Arab Spring, which has been focused on, sort of turning over a new leaf internally, you turn it against the United States. The United States emerges as the big bogeyman here at just a moment when it could be the other way. What about that concern, Matthew?
Well, many people have argued that a U.S. strike would strengthen the hardliners in Iran and strengthen the current regime and weaken the opposition movement. But many Iran experts who I've talked to have said that the opposite is at least as plausible and maybe even more likely, which is that while in the short term you would likely get a rally around the flag effect as people obviously feel national sentiment after the country has been attacked, in the medium to short term this creates opportunities for opposition movements to criticize the current regime for bringing the crisis on the country. And then I guess the second thing that I would say is that again, I'm not arguing for a bolt out of the blue strike. I'm not arguing that the United States does this unilaterally.
Pretty close to it, I have to say. I mean, your headline, time to attack Iran, and right on down. It's pretty, maybe not a bolt today, but a bolt soon is your argument, is the heart of your argument.
Well, Tom, it's a complicated issue, and I had a few thousand words in that piece, so I couldn't lay out everything. But I do say in the piece that the United States should begin now building international support, and that would be a key part, getting international support, getting a United Nations Security Council resolution if at all possible, although it's likely that the Russians and the Chinese would veto any such measure. But I think by working in advance, getting international support, the United States can create legitimacy for the strike, which would reduce some of these anti-American concerns.
Do you turn the Islamic world against the United States again for, I don't know, a generation here if this would be the scenario?
Well, you know, it's not just the United States that's very threatened by Iran's nuclear program. Countries in the region are also quite concerned. We had the Saudis explicitly asking the United States to, quote, cut the head off the snake, referring to Iran. So I think many in the Arab world, while they might criticize the United States and government, would, behind closed doors, thank us for eliminating the Iranian nuclear threat.
We're talking about the sort of backroom debate over a military strike on Iran's nuclear capability. Matthew Koenig, Colin Cowell, please stand by. Carol's calling from Perrysburg, New York. A lot of callers to bring in here. Carol, you're first on the air. Thanks for calling.
Okay, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am very disturbed by this conversation and previous conversations about attacking Iran. First of all, Iran, I do believe, is a sovereign nation. I do believe that Israel has 200 to 400 fully armed nuclear weapons, and the United States can blow up the world 50 times over. I think if Iran has a right to have a nuclear weapon, but we use anything, and I don't even know if they're building one. They say they are using it for nuclear
power and medical applications.
And medical facilities.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say this. This Matthew that I'm listening to, his logic, let's go to war. Let's go to war. I am so sick and tired of this juvenile mentality. David Brooks of the Times, before we went into Iraq, his cheeks went pink. We've got to go in and fight. I think we have to evolve. I am tired of this juvenile, adolescent kind of thing that we can attack anywhere we want. And if these people did not have oil and gas, and Africa have its rare minerals, and Haiti its rare minerals, we would not bother with them. And I think it's time we tended to our own business. And I just am tired of the politicians. I grow up. That's what I think. Grow up. This earth is fragile, and human beings, when we do strikes, those are human beings, and it hurts when your children go blowing up in the air. I am disgusted. I'm 75. My father was in World War I, and this never ends, and we never learn.
Carol, we've got it loud and clear. I'll put it to Matthew Koenig. And Matthew, there has been a fair amount of this in response to your piece, saying this is kind of, you know, video game understanding of human life. This is too ready to go in and get military, talking surgical strikes. But you hear palpably Carol's kind of disgust with this whole avenue. She calls it juvenile. What do you say?
Well, I understand her concerns, and I share them. I mean, war is hell. And the United States just got out of Iraq. We're winding down in Afghanistan. We've been at war for 10 years in both of those places, and nobody wants another conflict. That said, you know, if the choice were between a strike on Iran or the status quo, that would be easy. The status quo would be preferable. The problem is that Iran is driving toward nuclear weapons. The point was raised that maybe they're just interested in energy. I think on those energy claims, Iran's only fooling people who want to be fooled. It's pretty clear what they're driving at. And a nuclear-armed Iran poses a real danger to the region and to the world. A nuclear-armed Iran would likely feel emboldened to increase support to terrorists and proxies, would likely be more aggressive in terms of its course of diplomacy. It would lead to greater proliferation as other countries in the region acquire nuclear weapons, as Iran itself becomes a nuclear supplier, helps U.S. adversaries in other regions acquire nuclear weapons. And let's not forget, there's always the possibility of nuclear war. And while I don't think that Iran would intentionally launch a nuclear war, given the instabilities in the region, there's always the possibility that a future crisis between Iran and Israel or Iran and the United States could result in nuclear war.
Colin, before we go to the break here, if I may, excuse me, Matthew, but you hear Carol, you hear the sort of visceral, deep rejection of this. Is she wrong in that?
No, I mean, I don't think she's wrong. I think I would hope that the vast majority of Americans would choose not to go to war if there's any other alternative. And I mean, that's basically the point that I make in our piece, which is that we're not close to exhausting all the alternatives. And while I think Matt is trying to be careful here about saying that he's not arguing for a war now, his argument has certainly been picked up by those who are. I think that there is a raging war fever among some in Washington, D.C., especially on the right, among some Republicans and neoconservatives. This is being folded in to the election campaign, where Republican candidates believe Iran is the one hawkish issue they can try to bludgeon the administration with. And I think arguments like Matt's, however careful they are, can be used for dangerous ends.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the backroom debate over war with Iran, an argument to strike now or very soon against Iran's nuclear program, an argument that that would be rash, unwise, costly, too costly. Matthew Koenig is with us. His article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs is Time to Attack Iran, Why a Strike is the Least Bad Option. Colin Call is with us. His article in the same issue of Foreign Affairs, Not Time to Attack Iraq, Why War Should Be a Last Resort. They are both rather recently out of the Pentagon in different capacities there, both now at Georgetown University. Matthew Cullen, all kinds of response online here. All up and down the range. Terry says, start a war with Iran. Are these people crazy? Christopher says, I believe both your guests are arguing with the wrong premise that it's unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. I'd rather nobody had nuclear weapons. But if you look at the situation from their perspective, the Iranians, it's clear they need one to stave off an attack by either the U.S. or Israel. We just beat the tar out of the two countries on either side of Iran. Who's the real aggressor here? Alan says, now's the time to strike Iran. Syria's in chaos, which means no resupply for Hezbollah. U.S. troops are out of Iraq. They won't have to fight their way out. And kind of a political aside, he says, and for Bibi, Netanyahu and the right wingers on the planet, war would sink Obama. Lots of ways of looking at this. Evan calling from Patton, Vermont. Evan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just bring attention to using the Iraq war as an example of this, of where we're going again. At the onset of the Iraq War, I listened to two people. One was Scott Ritter, who's an ex-Marine and written many books on Mideast and war conflicts there. And the other was Rania Masur, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, who is a Mideast woman and a human rights advocate. And they both, at the onset of the war, were trying with every energy they had to stave it off, and they called it to a T. They called it a decades-long war. They called it to a T about the death toll that had gone on, the loss of treasure, and our own soldiers that went on.
And what do you take from that when it comes to Iran?
Oh, I'm sorry, my phone just cut out. What I take from that in this case is that we keep listening. We owe these people the credit. They were correct then. And they called it so close that we should be listening to them more instead of listening to the military-industrial complex again to encourage us to go into war again. It never works. It is a lost cause all the time. There are always better ways to do it, and we have to start doing it that way. And those are two examples of people whose their philosophies were exactly on the money. And I don't know why I don't hear them. We should be talking to those people now. We shouldn't be talking to the same people that want to put us back in the same position. And as a society, as a culture, we keep listening to the wrong people and not revisiting the situations and talking to the people that actually called it correctly.
Evan, we got it loud and clear, and we'll hear a lot of voices on this subject, I guarantee you, over time. And I appreciate your call. Matthew Koenig, you hear that, saying, look, let's look at options here. Cut it out. Don't take us down this road again. There's got to be another way. Let's get a little more creative here, Matthew.
Well, I think that there are three possible ways that this could end. The first is that Iran and the international community come to some kind of negotiated settlement over Iran's nuclear program. The second is that we acquiesce to an Iranian nuclear capability. Or the third is we conduct a preventive strike. Now, I think that all of those options are bad ones. The first, a diplomatic settlement, would obviously be preferable if we could get it. I just think it's highly unlikely that there is any overlap between what the Supreme Leader of Iran would be willing to accept in terms of limits on his nuclear program and inspections on its nuclear program, and what would reassure the international community, what would reassure the United States that Iran's nuclear program is no longer a problem. So I'd be delighted if that worked out. I just see that as a fairly low probability. And then we're faced with this really terrible dilemma that I start my article with, which is what is worse, a nuclear-armed Iran or a preventive military strike designed to prevent that? And so they're bad options. But when you consider the costs of a nuclear-armed Iran threatening international peace and security for decades to come, I think that the preventive strike is a bad but less bad option.
Colin, let's look at sanctions for a moment. The Obama administration has been very aggressive since it tried to talk to Iran. Iran didn't respond to that. It's gone after sanctions. They are mounting rapidly around Iran right now, so much so that some think the sanctions themselves might lead possibly to military conflict. But might this be settled through a combination of sanctions and negotiation? And then what about the costs of a nuclear-armed Iran? Are they really greater, ultimately, than the cost of the war path with Iran?
So, as you noted earlier, we're basically on the cusp of the most significant sanctions Iran has ever experienced, targeting its oil sector. You know, the Europeans this week voted on an oil embargo. The United States Congress and the administration have put in place a set of sanctions that are about to kick in the coming months on Iran's central bank, which for your listeners, they need to understand that if Iran wasn't able to use its central bank to conduct financial transactions, it basically wouldn't be able to sell its oil on the global market to most customers. So the combination of U.S. central bank sanctions, which would encourage others around the world to not buy Iranian oil, and the European oil embargo could potentially in the coming months be a huge dagger in the heart of the Iranian economy. The question is whether that will be sufficient to get the Iranians back to the table to negotiate in good faith. Thus far, the kind of incremental sanctions that the United States and the West has pursued along with the other members of the United Nations have not been sufficient. But it could be the case that current sections or sanctions that are coming down the pipe in terms of oil will be so severe that the regime will have to take them seriously and we maybe can have a negotiated outcome. And we'll have to see. I mean, the Iranians have been making noises in the last couple weeks. Even as they've been rattling sabers in the strait, they've been making noises that they're willing to return to the negotiating table. So I think we have to let that play out and not rush into war. As it relates to your second question, which is what's worse, a nuclear Iran or a military strike? I actually don't think that's the right way to frame the question. Mm-hmm. Because it presumes that a military strike solves the problems that Matt identifies in his article. It doesn't. At most, it buys you a couple of years, and it probably drives the Iranian program more deeply underground and motivates them even more to go for a nuclear weapon, a decision they haven't made in the current context but would in the aftermath of being struck by the United States. You know, one of the strange examples that Matt uses in his article is that the 1981 Israeli attack on Iraq's nuclear program, its reactor at Osirak, stopped the program in Iraq. It did no such thing. Iraq reconstituted its program. It did it covertly. It did it at clandestine sites. It did it in a much more dispersed and redundant fashion, so much so that when the United States invaded Iraq to expel them from Kuwait in 1991, we discovered that they were a lot further along in their clandestine nuclear program than we ever believed before. Iran would do the same thing. So a strike is not a solution to the nuclear problem. It simply kicks that can down the road. And containment is not an alternative to a strike. A strike would require us to put tens of thousands of troops encircling Iran for decades to contain them, to prevent them from reconstituting their program. So I think there's this canard that we're left with this choice between striking Iran or living with the bomb when that choice is just simply false.
Matthew Crane, if there's going to be containment costs on either way. You can contain it before, you contain it after, so better not to make the strike.
Well, I think there would be containment cost either way, but the containment cost of a nuclear-armed Iran would obviously be much higher than the containment costs for a non-nuclear Iran.
Why is that the case? That assumes that Iran would use or credibly threaten to use those weapons.
Well, let's just think about how we've done tried to deter and contain nuclear-armed states in the past. If you think about the Soviet Union or North Korea, one of the things that we've done is extended our nuclear umbrella to our regional allies, and that's something that I think we'd have to do with a nuclear-armed Iran. Essentially, sign formal defense pacts with Saudi Arabia, other Gulf states, perhaps with Israel,
so that Iran faced the prospect of destruction if it attacked an American ally.
Exactly. So, let's be clear about what that means. That means the United States would be threatening essentially to fight a nuclear war on behalf of Saudi Arabia, Israel, other states in the region. So is the United States really willing to trade New York for Riyadh, to paraphrase a question Charles de Gaulle asked?
Would Iran have the capacity to hit New York?
Well, currently, Iran doesn't have that capacity. They would first have to miniaturize their nuclear weapons to fit on the nose cone of ballistic missiles, and they would have to get ballistic missiles with ranges of reaching the United States. Right now, estimates are that Iran could have – Secretary Gates said that Iran, if it got international assistance, could have ballistic missiles capable of reaching the east coast of the United States within 5 years. It's not a short-term threat, but if Iran gets nuclear weapons, There's only been one country in history to give up nuclear weapons, South Africa. So if Iran acquired a nuclear capability, it would likely have that capability for years, for decades, perhaps longer. So we can't think in terms – when we think about the cost of a nuclear-armed Iran, we can't think about what are the threats in the next 6 months. We have to have a longer perspective.
Colin says strike them. And on the other side of that, they're very likely to go right back and work even harder to get that weapon. The know-how won't go away, even if some of their facilities do. We will have used our threat up already. So we're right back in the same dilemma on the other side of a very costly strike. What about that, Matthew?
Well, one of the things that Colin said is that if we struck, it would motivate them to even further to get nuclear weapons. But that assumes that Iran isn't already motivated to get nuclear weapons, which I think is
inaccurate. No, it assumes that on the other side of that, they'd still be motivated, and we would already. And now we've had a war in the middle.
So what I argue in the piece is that we should key the decision to use force if Iran crosses certain red lines, if it enriches to 90%, if it kicks out international inspectors. Those would be telltale signs that Iran is moving to build nuclear weapons in short order. So at that point, the choice is between essentially acquiescing to the nuclear capability or conducting a strike. So the idea that a strike somehow puts them closer to acquiring nuclear weapons, I think, is inaccurate.
Not necessarily closer, but doesn't necessarily take away the motivation or the know-how. We're looking at arguments for and against a military strike on Iran. You can hear a lot of our listeners saying, we want another conversation here, but this one's going on right now. We're paying attention. Scott in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what do you think, Scott?
What do I think? I think that here in the United States, we have such a limited vision. I think that, propaganda, the propaganda machine that we have going is not even close to the one that they have going. This isn't about Iran. This isn't about Iran's ability to attack or whatever. You know, Ronald Reagan destabilized the entire Russian economy with a system of Star Wars that didn't even work. And that's what the Arab nations are doing to us right at this moment. I mean, we have assets, we have contractors, we have military, and we send them wherever we are called to. And they are strategically and surgically picking us apart financially to the point of where our country will be totally destabilized in a matter of years. It doesn't matter if they have a bomb or if it works or it doesn't work. All it matters is that they get us out there. You know, we are sending our troops, we are fueling our Humvees, you know, our MRAPs and everything else with their gasoline. They are absolutely on a regular basis. I mean, it's been talked about recently what's going on in Afghanistan right now.
Scott, I've got the argument there that the U.S. is being bled dry by these threats and the military response. Colin, where's the hole in the gas tank here? What about that argument? We cannot, and many people are making this online, the U.S. cannot afford this kind of approach, this kind of talk. The U.S. just can't do this, can't afford it.
Well, I mean, I think that people need to be cautious that, if my argument is right that a surgical strike would not be surgical, that it would actually lead to a more expansive campaign, then I think the cost could be significant, to include the possibility of substantially increased oil prices as a consequence of actions in the Strait of Hormuz. And even if the Iranians didn't close the strait, the mere threat that it might could send oil prices skyrocketing. So that would have a dramatic effect on our economy. Mm-hmm. I also think I want to go back to something. It's actually related, something that Matt just said a minute ago about how, you know, Iran would not be more motivated. Let's be clear about something. The Iranians are putting themselves into a position to make the final decision to develop nuclear weapons. They have not, or at least we don't have hard evidence that they have, not made that final decision. Mm-hmm. After a strike, they will know that the only way to guarantee something in the future, to deter such a strike in the future, will be to have a bomb in the basement like the North Koreans did in the mm-hmm. 1990s. And what would happen the day after the strike? They would pull out of the NPT. They would kick out IAEA inspectors, accusing them of being Zionist spies and, mm-hmm. and CIA moles. And therefore, the international community would be a lot less likely to actually be able to detect the reconstitution of Iran's program because inspectors would be out. It wouldn't be all that different from the 1980s when Saddam reconstituted his program. And that means that we would have to deploy tens of thousands of troops in perpetuity to encircle Iran to do renewed strikes at a moment's notice to prevent them from reconstituting their program. That is a recipe for tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of expenses.
Let me ask you, here's a listener on Facebook. Jeffrey says, Israel will do what they must and take out Iran's nuclear capability. In return, the world will publicly heap condemnation on the Israelis while privately being very grateful. Tom Ricks writes on his blog recently, you know, that he hears a lot of talk that there's a good chance Israel will attack Iran sometime this year and that we, the U.S., will get sucked into the ensuing mess. What about the Israel factor here, Colin?
I actually think that the danger of an Israeli strike in 2012 is something that we have to take very seriously. You know, Matt made reference to two enrichment facilities, the one at Natanz and a second one in the at the Fordo facility inside the inside a mountain near the city of Qom. That is a very hard target for the Israelis. Minister of Defense Ehud Barak, the Israeli Minister of Defense, has stated repeatedly that Israel does not have the conventional capability to get at the enrichment facility at Qom. And so there's a very real danger that as Qom comes online, it's already they've already installed two cascades of centrifuges there and moved some of their low-enriched uranium there. Mm-hmm. As that becomes more and more operational, then there becomes a capability for the that the Iranians have that's, that could be out of reach of the Israeli military, which could prompt them to do a now-or-never attack. So I think that, that there's a real danger that the Israelis are contemplating that. And I would agree, actually, with the person who wrote the question that if the Israelis do this, there's a decent probability we'll get sucked into the vortex.
Israelis could start it. Could they finish it on their own or not, Colin?
Well, you know, I think our U.S. officials have publicly stated that an Israeli strike could set back the program maybe 1 to 3 years. You know, Matt correctly noted earlier the Israelis have far fewer capabilities than the United States. They don't really have the ability to launch a large-scale campaign. So I think an Israeli strike is the worst of all worlds, limited effects, most of the downside risks.
Matthew, if Israel goes in, does the U.S. necessarily follow?
I would agree with everything Colin just said, that the Israeli option is probably the worst option, and there is a danger that the United States would get drawn into the conflict.
Well, watch this space, and let's pray it goes another way. Matthew Kronig's article is Time to Attack Iran, Why a Strike is the Least Bad Option in the Current Foreign Affairs. Matthew Kronig, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Colin Call's piece is Not Time to Attack Iran, Why War Should Be a Last Resort. Colin, thank you for your time and insights today.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.